Author of the Week, with Jessica Burtis, Alex Lefchuk, and of course, another sensationally talented purveyor of perfect prose.
But who's the author?
Let's find out.
So what is it about Arthur Conan Doyle that actually leads to his resonance centuries almost after he started writing his Sherlock Holmes, etc.? And why is it that one of our ace authors of the 21st century is allegedly smitten with Arthur Conan Doyle? Well, we're about to find out, because we're going to speak to the creator of Catalyst, Heart of the Inferno. It's the awesome Nicole Fanning. How are you, Nicole?
I'm well. How are you, Alex?
I'm good. And just to sort of confirm, whereabouts in the United States are we reaching you at present?
So I actually live in Central Florida. So yeah, nice and humid down here.
So, and very much the heart of Ground Zero for so many sort of wonderful things there, which is
very
great
much
there.
So.
Nicole, we have a fascinating biography for yourself, an old school romantic, a proclivity for a little mischief, and this obsession with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. So please share with us, are you a kind of fan of the Sherlock Holmes era, or are you talking about the Lost World? Are we talking about his experiments with respect to parapsychology, his fascination with the paranormal? What aspects of Arthur Conan Doyle have appealed to you?
So I mean, obviously, I don't think you can like be a fan of Arthur Conan Doyle without at least being somewhat of a fan of his works with Sherlock Holmes. And just those amazing webs that he was able to weave, you know, even at that time for the reader, and how like influential that was, just, you know, how it went out to the public. But then also his obsession with, like you said, the psychology and the paranormal, like those things were just really fascinating, because it showed the depth of his person too, and where his mind was at. So it's kind of like being able to, when I always feel like when you read something, you get to see into that person's soul a little bit. So when we see his work and we see his research and we see, you know, like all the things he dabbled in, it was kind of his way of like showing us his soul and his true self. And that's, I think that's why I'm obsessed with him.
I'm just thinking, as an American, wouldn't Edgar Allan Poe have been a kind of more logical precursor to Arthur Conan Doyle? Or is it a case of, no, we go with ACD?
Yep. My grandparents were obsessed with all things like European. And in fact, my grandmother said that she wanted to retire in London, and that's where she wanted to be. And so I kind of grew up with those first. So I watch a lot of like British TV. I have started there. I would definitely say yes, Edgar Allan Poe is especially influential as well. But for some reason, Arthur stole my heart.
Well, that makes perfect sense. So let's move into Catalyst, Heart of the Inferno. Now, a catalyst is defined as a classic element that causes a reaction to take place, but the end of the reaction remains untouched, effectively. So
yeah.
Why are we looking at Catalyst, Heart of the Inferno, an action romance about the terrifying and dangerous mafia lord Jackson Pace and, of course, Natalie Taylor?
Are you asking kind of like why I chose Catalyst as the title?
Let's go with that to start off with.
Yeah. So I became kind of obsessed with the idea of the stages of a fire. And, you know, you have different stages of that progression, but typically there are like four stages. So you have the catalyst, which comes into the situation and creates that reaction, but then is removed from the situation. Then you have like the actual ignition of the fire, which is when it takes flame. Then you would have the flashpoint, and you would have like the decay afterwards, which, you know, is kind of like how the fires go. So it's like a curve. Catalyst for me was twofold. One, it showed two people that would otherwise have never have met, except for this chance meeting, both that are broken in some ways and also needing something in some ways. And so when they come together, it kind of is that like that bang. And they each provide something that the other doesn't have, but they in themselves, it's not that they are missing it as a person, it's just their lives are better for that reaction. And I think that it's significant because in Jackson Pace's world, when Natalie comes into it, he's kind of closed off in the world. He suffered some tragedy. He suffered some hard times in his life. And when he, you know, and obviously he runs this mafia, so he's got a lot going on too. And so he's kind of closed off as far as like heart and his love kind of goes. And then when he meets Natalie, he's kind of like, he's never had that experience with someone where one, she wants nothing to do with him because he was a total jerk to her. And two, she did something completely selfless for him in the fact that she saves his daughter. And so she kind of thwarts a kidnapping of his daughter. And that's where he's like, who is this person and why is she doing this? And when he kind of finds out that she did it just because she's a good person and that was what she thought was the right thing to do, he's like, that can't be true. Like, it just doesn't register in his brain. Natalie, on the other hand, she's a very interesting character too. I mean, we tend to get focused on Jackson because he's a billionaire and he's a CEO and he's a mafia lord. But Natalie is quiet, but not shy and not weak. She is observant. She is brave. She is courageous. And she kind of exemplifies that, you know, just because I can do something doesn't mean I should, or, you know, maybe if there's a situation in front of me that I could make better, I'm going to do so. But when it comes to myself, I'm going to be very selfless. So she has a very interesting situation going on. She has come to Chicago for her cousin's wedding. Her cousin is best friends with this Jackson, her cousin is best friends with her fiance, her ex-fiance. And the ex-fiance is kind of in her life because the family is so used to him at this point. He's been the best friend of her cousin for so long. He's always been around. And she and him broke up, but she's still forced to be in that proximity with him, or she doesn't get her family. And so for the last 2 years after the breakup, she hasn't had her family in her life. So she comes into the situation kind of like, I'm just going to survive this week, this wedding week, I'm going to get through it. And she immediately is thrust in the situation where she sees this potential kidnapping taking place. And she's like, I cannot allow this to happen. She steps in, she, you know, does a killer job of, you know, stopping it, and then puts herself in front of Jackson Pace. And so she, in that moment, kind of has that first realization that she's like, well, I stopped this kidnapping. And then when Jackson was obviously kind of a jerk to her, cause he was very, you know, guards up, very suspicious of her reasoning. She kind of puts him in his place. Like, she doesn't take, you know, his crap, and she's not going to put up with his attitude because she's like, I did you a favor, man. I did something awesome for you. You should not be treating me this way. And he is completely floored by this reaction because women just roll over for him. And she's like, no, absolutely not. I deserve better from you. But it kind of, again, is that catalyst for her as well, that she realizes like, yeah, I do deserve better. So we kind of see that initial reaction. So their meeting ends up giving her a type of strength. Like, I take that back. I shouldn't say that. He doesn't give her any strength. He allows her to realize her own strength. So I think that's where he becomes that catalyst for her, just as she's become a catalyst for him to kind of open up and let those walls down.
Sounds phenomenal. And here was I thinking that the mafia had actually done it all in Sicily, but still, there it goes. We're joined now by somebody who is originally from a little bit further north of Florida. She's based from a North Carolina soul, but still sort of connected with that. By the way, Nicole, whereabouts in Florida are you? Because obviously it's a fairly big state.
Yes, so I'm in Central Florida. I'm in a little place outside of Orlando, so I'm close to Orlando.
So the Disney people are just waiting to actually say, we need to buy the rights to Catalyst Heart of Inferno and have a theme park ride based on the mafia. Oh, maybe not. I don't know.
I don't know if it'll be a Disney movie material. There's definitely some adult concepts
Maybe you'll go for Disney stars
or maybe something else.
Exactly. Anyway, Jessica Burtis, welcome to the Author of the Week piece. You've been listening to, obviously, Nicole there. Any thoughts that you'd like to share, or indeed any questions you'd like to put to Nicole?
Yeah, well, first I have to say that it's really nice to hear that the protagonist of this book is quiet but still has a spine. I think that's really great, you know, that she's dynamic. And I actually am curious about how you chose to bring the mafia element in, because I saw in your bio that you've always been into,
Arthur Conan Doyle.
Thank you. I could not remember his first name. So I'm kind of curious about how, you know, you got into this element of crime and kind of mafia life in Chicago for the book.
So Chicago actually has a long history with different kinds of mafias. And
well, Al Capone did some good stuff there, I believe, back in the
day. A little bit, right?
had a few tax issues, but, you know, so it goes.
Right. And so when I started this, like, I didn't know a whole lot. So what I did was I first started my research on not only like where the mafia was located, but what kinds of mafia. Because we always tend to think, like you said, the Sicilian mafia. But there is actually like a Scottish mafia, Irish flair mafia, there's a Greek mafia, it's all over the place. And my kind of obsession with Sherlock Holmes and what I loved about him was he always saw like what other people didn't see. And so the whole idea of the mafia was that they kind of exist in the shadows. But how I explain it in my book is that they aren't good men, but they are the bad men who keep worse men in check. So they kind of work with the government, with the officials, to kind of keep a level of crime that's reasonable and to kind of carry out their own justice in situations that would normally be denied. There is a situation in book two where a young lady kind of has been denied that justice from someone who is very high up in high society because he kind of got off with, you know, different ways of getting around any type of, you know, problems with the government. And the mafia kind of steps in and handles that. And so Jackson kind of says, like, it's like an ecosystem, you know, in order for government and crime to thrive, you also have to have kind of that predator prey mentality. So they keep that organized level of crime. And what they do is they just kind of feel that their job is to provide what your government has deemed you unable to make a decision for something yourself. So their view on like drugs or prostitution or things like that is that it's your body, it's your choice, and we're going to provide it. What you do with it is your business. And so they don't kind of take a morality standpoint on that. They just say like, we're here to provide that service. And we do that to keep our police officers, keep our government officials, keep those programs running, because if there was no crime, there would be no jobs for those things either, which would, you know, kind of come back for unemployment. So he kind of ties it all together when he's explaining this to Natalie, which is also something really interesting about Jackson, is that Natalie's first request and only request from Jackson is when they start to, you know, kind of break the ice after that initial frigid meeting is, you know, just be honest with me. And so he has that choice where he can kind of keep up that mafia mask that he always keeps up. You know, he's high society, he's a billionaire. People don't know this about him, or he can tell her the truth, and he chooses to tell her the truth. And again, we kind of see that like that badass quality to her where she isn't typically gonna like run away the second she hears it, which is also something we see a lot in TV, is like when the guy reveals the truth and then the girl's like, I can't deal with this, and she runs away. Natalie's kind of like, I'm gonna take a minute, I'm gonna process it, but from what I know about you as a person, like, he's not someone that's just going to go out and unnecessarily cause carnage, because as he's explained, it's all connected. And kind of like Arthur Conan Doyle, he wove these amazing webs and he showed us like how they're all reactive to each other. That's exactly kind of how this book is too. Like one, it's that ecosystem. One, if one thing is failing, then the rest of the system falls too. So does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting how you kind of do delve into that whole system and how you make the mafia in this story not just like kind of something cardboard that's there to make it interesting. Like, it's very organic and it's necessary, and you explain it very interestingly. I am curious, are you into like mafia movies like The Godfather or Gangs of New York or anything like that?
So I have watched The Godfather. I like the first one the most. In fact, my husband always makes fun of me because I do the "I'll make you an offer you can't refuse." Like, I always do that impression. But I also watched a lot of Peaky Blinders, and so that there's definitely some hints of that in the system too, because that's another show that kind of hints that not everything is as pure and white as it's cracked up to be. You know, it is kind of that system. So yeah, I've watched some of that, but most of what I've done has been like actual research. There's different mafias that come into this. And in fact, we learn in the book that like Jackson is kind of what's called the Don Supreme. So there's multiple mafias in Chicago, but he is the most powerful. So he's kind of overseeing everything, but therefore it's his responsibility to make sure that all the pieces kind of stay in check. And then in book two, we actually see some different cultural influences come in too, because it's set partially in Miami. So there's the cartel and there's different things there too. So I just found all of that so fascinating. I'm hoping that I didn't do too much research. Like I'm hoping that nobody shows up at my door and is like, how do you know all of this? Or like your Google search history has been very strange and we're concerned. So
it's a whole new thought. Let's just move on to your rescue dogs. You've got three of them. Are they actually called Sherlock, Moriarty, and Watson?
They're not. I always say like they kind of chose their own names. My husband chose the one for our largest dog. He's a rescue from the Bahamas. I have no idea what his breed is. He kind of looks like a corgi and a dash hound had a baby. He's like long and chubby and got short little legs, and kind of like hound dog ears. And then I have a chihuahua who's named Loki, because he is the one that the other two bigger dogs are terrified of, even though he's like the biggest baby. But chihuahuas just kind of have that like, I'm big, tough stuff energy. So he's the little guy. And then I have an American Eskimo. I don't know if you can see him in the background, but he is my Velcro dog. He is with me the moment, like I wake up in the morning, he's always there. So he's a piece of work. He's got all the, we have very similar traits. We both don't like being hot, which is funny because we live in Florida. and we're both very high energy type people. So every time I'm writing, he's with me. And I always joke that he's my poof reader because he's got really fluffy fur. So I'm like, you're my poof reader. You're my buddy.
It opens up a whole range of sort of elements within that. I've got to ask the question, would you call them Baskervilles? I mean, you know, a collective noun.
The Hounds of the Baskervilles. I have exactly. Definitely called them, yes, the Hounds of the Baskerville, for sure. For sure.
Miami has got a wonderful sort of record. I mean, obviously, you've got lots of crime series that have been set there. You're too young to remember Miami Vice. We can actually go on to, obviously, Burn Notice. We've got the excitement of, obviously, NCIS New Orleans and other areas within that. Do you think that that kind of proximity to, obviously, the coast, the glamour, the sort of the drug cartels, is that something that has also inspired your writing, Nicole?
I think something I did try to include in my books, was again, that cultural aspect. So like in book two, they are in Miami, and, you know, definitely try to talk about like different aspects of like that life and, you know, what that culture is like as well. And, you know, some of Jackson's men are, you know, they come from different diverse backgrounds as well. Like, so he has his second in command is named Ethan and his third in command is named Charlie. And Charlie is an orphan from Haiti. And so Charlie grew up in Miami, you know, as his parents sent him there. And so he's very familiar with the cartel and, you know, kind of the gangs that they come into contact with. He's very aware of like their processes and how they do things. But I think what's really cool is that I grew up in Michigan. So I grew up in the Midwest and I lived in California for a time. And then, you know, living in Florida, I've had, you know, different exposure to different cultures. And I just think that like, it's so beautiful when you are able to incorporate those things, that it would be an opportunity to miss that. And so like, even when I describe Jackson or Natalie, I made a deliberate effort to describe their hair color and their eye color, but I don't describe their skin color or their ethnic background, because I did feel like what I wanted to do was allow, you know, a reader is going to imagine the main characters however they want to. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to paint that picture for them. I want them to be able to paint that picture. So we've created this very diverse cultural background. So Jackson you know, could look however you want him to look. Same with Natalie as well. But it was a deliberate effort there to, you know, try to be as inclusive as possible. And, you know, when set in those different settings in Chicago or in Miami, that we are touching on what's actually culturally relevant for those places as much as we can.
So is there much Natalie in Your Good Self, or is there any Nicole in Natalie? I mean, is it a case of you kind of identify with this? I mean, I don't want to probe too much on this, but, you know, have we sort of had any sort of a crossover there from your own experiences?
So I would say that Natalie is a little bit of me and a little bit of the women closest to me. I actually identify more with her feisty cousin, Steph, who's like the defender of Natalie. But Natalie is kind of a representation of like the friends that were closest to me and like their experiences. And I would say that Natalie is like even a better person than I am. She's who I want to be in my soul. Like, she is always like that forgiving. She's always going to choose, you know, to do the right thing, even when it's hard for her. And we see, like, in the book, kind of allows you to see some of her one line thoughts as they're happening. She's very good under pressure. So like if a crazy situation is happening, like when the kidnapping situation was happening, she stays calm in that situation. I don't know if I would stay calm in that same situation. I'm sure I would be shaking. But Natalie is a nurse. So she is used to kind of those chaotic situations where you have to let your emotions take the back seat and your logic take front seat. So I think that's what gives her that courage aspect. But she's really interesting in the sense that, again, she's quiet, but she is courageous and brave and witty. And she kind of goes to show that, like, while Jackson is like physical strength, you know, like big mafioso tough guy, she is that quiet, nurturing energy that's supportive. And she, you know, you could easily overlook her, but it would be a huge mistake because she is kind of that. And I always saw, you know, I have friends that are stay-at-home moms, and I feel like they have a sense of strength that is so understated, because, you know, they can be loving and nurturing and sweet, and you come over to their house and they'll give you a glass of lemonade. But if you touch one of their babies, like, mama bear is going to come out, and a level of like strength and courage and even rage at points will be there. And Natalie, I think, encompasses all of those things. Like, she is kind of that, yep, I'm just gonna, you know, sit back and let things happen. Okay, now I'm not. Like, there's definitely a limit there. She's all the things I wish I could be. And, you know, maybe that's like a goal for myself to kind of be like that.
Or you're creating her in another reality, in another dimension, in another sort of existence. So
it all works. That's right. There. I like that. That's a good one. I like that.
Nicole, are you in any way connected with Dakota Fanning? Because I do know when we actually did the whole the link, etc., we got a lot of shots of Dakota Fanning, but we finally sort of managed to dig deep to actually find Nicole Fanning. Any connection there whatsoever?
No, I wish there was. I wish there was. But when I try to tell people how to spell my name, I usually say, like, Dakota Fanning. But no connection.
So you weren't in War of the Worlds with Tom Cruise back in the day?
I was not. No.
That's fine. Jessica, anything else you'd like to go with?
I'm very curious about how you balance writing with, you know, the rest of your life, you know, because it sounds like you have a very happy household with like the dogs and everything. And it sounds so nice to have like all those pets. So I'm very curious about how you go about balancing all that.
So this was something I was very fortunate when I first started out writing. I found a video of a YouTuber who talked about how your biggest challenge with writing is going to be to set a writing habit, but setting that writing habit is going to be what pulls you through on the days that it's difficult, because some days you are going to feel like writing. You're going to wake up, you know, filled with energy and filled with inspiration. And then, as we all know, some days we wake up and we don't. We are, you know, on that struggle bus and we are not interested. And so this wonderful YouTuber, and I wish I knew her name off the top of my head, but she talked about how when you set that writing habit, it sets that expectation in your head. So you sit down and you start writing, and you may go back in an hour or in a day or in a week, and you may say, wow, I don't like anything that I just wrote today. And you may rewrite it, but you might still find that you're keeping bits and pieces of it, which is what made it important. So I would say that every single day I have written something, whether it was on my phone, whether it was on my computer. And definitely some days it felt like it was a tiny little drop in a bucket. But I found, and I said this to my husband too, I found that I published so that people could read it and they could also enjoy it. But I write for myself because it brings me joy to create that world, to have that little bit of escapism. And I think that that's really, really important as a writer, is to have that writing habit. I have ADD, so I can get a bit distracted at times. So what I did for myself to make it easier was I have the whole plot set for all of the Heart of the Inferno series. And I wrote out each book's what I called the skeleton. So it was basically the spine of the book, what each chapter was going to feature. And so I know that for books 1, 2, and 3. And that made it easier for me. Like if I was on a day where I was full of energy and I wanted to write from, like, maybe I had that really aggressive Jackson Pace energy and it's like that fight scene, and I'm like, I'm gonna go write that today. But then maybe I'm like in my feels and I want to write a romance scene, so I'm writing that from like Natalie's perspective. But it allowed me to kind of skip around with like the main course of each chapter, and then to just kind of go back and smooth things over, connecting everything together. And some days I would find I would write in sequential order, and other days I would find that I did jump around. But taking that pressure off of myself to write in sequential order, whether I felt like writing that chapter or not, was very effective. And then also just knowing every single day, like, that was my habit. I have to sit down and I have to write something. And there, I promise you, there were days that I got in bed and I was like, I haven't written anything today. And I would actually get myself out of bed and I would go sit and I would write for an hour. Some of that content never made it into a book, but it was okay. I still sat and wrote for it. So, but I think if you kind of find what works for yourself and you don't try to shove yourself, you know, if you're a round hole into a square peg or square peg into a round hole, don't try to take that mentality where you're forcing yourself to do something, but you're still holding yourself to that accountability and making that effort. I think anybody can write, no matter, you know, like if what their content is or what they're writing about. So.
Catalyst, of course, the launch in this trilogy, Heart of the Inferno. Ignite, I think, also around. How soon or how long will we have to wait until the third episode is launched on the world?
So it is already under construction. I told myself, so book one admittedly kind of ends on a bit of a cliffhanger. Nobody's dead, so nobody dies, no worries there. but I will say that, like, with the Catalyst, as you said, it comes into the situation, but then it leaves. It doesn't stay. So something kind of happens with the two of them that they feel like, you know, that they have to separate for a moment. But Ignite, which is the second book, picks up immediately where Catalyst left off. So when I published Catalyst, I knew that my readers were going to be like, where is Ignite? So the day that I published Catalyst, I was already writing Ignite. And so when I published Ignite, I was kind of like, I might want to take a break between writing Ignite and Flashpoint, because I didn't take any break whatsoever between 1 and 2. That didn't last. That went like 2 days and I was literally crawling the walls. Because again, like I publish for other people, but I write for myself. So I had set originally for spring of 2022 for the third and final book in the series. However, there is plans for this series to feature a lot of different perspectives. Like Heart of the Inferno is going to be Catalyst, Ignite, and Flashpoint. But there's going to be 11 books total in this series. And those other books will feature other perspectives, whereas Heart of the Inferno features just Jackson and Natalie's perspective. So we'll still have more to come. We'll still see more of them, but it just won't be from their direct perspectives exclusively. So, and we're looking at spring of 2022.
And any plans to actually incorporate any cameos from Chihuahuas or other rescue dogs in the narrative.
So there actually is a rescue dog in Catalyst and Ignite. His name is Cyclops, and he is a one-eyed rescue pug that Natalie has. Jackson is, again, like the mafia lord. He's got his big German shepherd, you know, tough guy dogs. And Cyclops is Natalie's, you know, little fun companion. And it's kind of cute because in Flashpoint, we see that Cyclops is actually running the show. So, you know, he's a tough guy, kind of like my Chihuahua is the smallest one of all my dogs, and he bosses the other two big ones around. So, yes, there'll definitely be some dog cameos in there.
Well, if it's good enough for Loki, it's good enough for mischief makers around the world, basically, including Chihuahuas, which is fantastic. Jessica, would you like to put those last two questions to Nicole at present, please?
I would love to. So, Nicole, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us?
I'm sorry, a Zoom what?
Have you had Zoomer, Nicole. It's what we call these things. You see, they used to be radio.
Oh, yes! Absolutely, I love it.
Let's call them Zoomers. So it's been okay for that. Excellent. And the next question, Jessica, is?
So can we welcome you back again?
Absolutely. You can welcome me back tomorrow if you want. I would absolutely come back, yes.
Amazing.
Well, it works through all sorts of things. And I suppose Arthur Conan Doyle, if he's looking down, he would say, yes, well, Zoom is what we used to actually gather around a seance table for. But, you know, it's a different thing. Is there anybody there? We're speaking to somebody in Florida. Amazing. It's great. And
it's
Ireland.
Crazy. Yeah.
And Lincoln. Nicole Fanning. Oh, one last thing, Nicole. How can people readers actually obviously get hold of the books? Are they available on all the usual platforms? And how can they actually follow you? Are you on? Do you have a Facebook page? And so on.
I do have a Facebook page. I'm working on an Instagram page. I'm on TikTok, and you can find them on Amazon and Kindle.
Nicole Fanning, creator, of course, of the Catalyst series. 11 books, eh?
Yep.
Go on. Why not make it 12? Go for a 12th. I'm sure that'll be there. You know, it'll
there you
happen.
Go. Lucky number 13.
Well, exactly. Keep on keeping on. And if any sort of mafia people come knocking on your door, just basically deny everything. I always find that works.
I was just going to blame it all on Google.
I think it's fair to say that one of my favorite Arthur C. Clarke laws is that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. So you might well say, what about superheroes then? And how can that relate to science and technology and engineering and mathematics and so on? Well, it does seem that in many ways there are connections between our heroes on the screen and the page and, of course, in the wonderful online world and indeed real life. But to actually explore this and how superheroes can actually be inspirational in their own way, we're delighted to welcome two fabulous individuals, one of whom is a genuine superhero or super relo. Let's start off with STEM ambassador extraordinaire James Young. How are you, James?
Hi there. Hi.
Excellent. You're keeping well, I take it, which is wonderful stuff. And we also have the deputy head for psychology and computer science at the University of Central Lancashire. That's the wonderful Dr. Sarita Robinson. How are you, Sarita?
I'm good, thank you.
Marvellous. So, Sarita, just before we actually start, were you ever bitten by a radioactive spider as a biology student or a psychology student? Have you ever sort of been tempted to actually go through the cosmic ray belt and become impacted like Reed Richards did with the Fantastic Four? Or is it just a case of, no, you are a natural superhero as deputy head of psychology?
I have to say it wasn't as easy as just getting bit by a radioactive spider to end up as the deputy head of school. I had to put a little bit more work in than perhaps Peter Parker managed on that costume change. But yeah, we're doing all right, I think.
Yeah, I didn't know. At the University of Lincoln, I mean, they're always testing our academic staff with being bitten by radioactive spiders. No, I won't go there. That's another line entirely. The key point, of course, with respect to this is how do superheroes begin to inspire people? I mean, I cite myself in a sense as an example. The reason I did a chemistry and biology degree back in the day was because I was inspired by Star Trek, Gerry Anderson and Doctor Who. So clearly we look at the current sort of vogue for popularities and you tend to think that, yeah, there are cases where if you look at Tony Stark as an industrialist, an inventor, etc., Helen Cho, a world-renowned geneticist, and we've got Hank McCoy, of course, from the X-Men, also a scientist from that point of view. So there is a kind of crossover, but people don't necessarily make that connection. Or are children still scared by scientists?
I think you make a really good point that, you know, if you talk to a lot of engineers and scientists today, they look back into their past and sort of can identify shows and movies that maybe were really inspirational. I'm just like you, Alex. I'm a big Doctor Who fan, and that was a key inspiration growing up. Ooh. I think the great thing that we've shown with the Institution of Engineering and Technology report is that, you know, over 90% of children think superheroes are cool. Yeah, so that there's still that draw into the sort of science fiction superhero world. I think what we need to do is just to try and make it a little bit more explicit to kids that there is a link between superheroes and the science and the technology.
Absolutely. Well, let's face it, Steve Rogers would have been nothing had it not been for Professor Erskine and his superhero serum that effectively worked through that. Well, I have to say, just going back briefly to Doctor Who, I always felt that the nuclear magnetic resonance meter and the spectrometers we used never quite managed to match up to the sonic screwdriver. And I was never able to say reverse the polarity of the neutron flow, but never mind. Yes. Let's turn to, as we mentioned, a real life superhero. That's James Young. James, it's fair to say that you have been made better than you were before, better, faster, fitter, stronger. I'm citing, of course, the $6 million man and the bionic connection there. James, share with us your own particular life pattern and why you've ended up as a STEM ambassador.
Yes, I don't know if we could say better just yet. I would say maybe different. I had an accident in 2012 whereby I lost my left arm and my left leg. And subsequently, just through recovery, I found that there was a call out for someone that was a gamer that wanted to build their own body part with the Alternative Limb Project. And I sort of jumped on it, just thinking that would be incredibly cool. And so I got to bring my own science fiction interests into reality with a team and help design my own body parts. And so basically, I incorporated alternative functions that were beyond normal human ability, like lights and a drone and USB charging lasers. So I kind of brought on different abilities. So I wouldn't necessarily say overall better, because the technology of control really isn't there yet in terms of bionics. So it's kind of a different direction, I suppose.
I don't know. I can see Victor Stone being very impressed with respect to that and seeing some of those aspects as things that they need to upgrade in terms of his cyborg outfit, which is there. And of course, actually, that's one of the key things, a cybernetic organism working on that basis. Now, Sarita James is a classic example as biometal of somebody who's kind of engaging with respect to a real life story. And one of the criticisms, of course, about science fiction and to a certain extent, certainly superhero fiction, is sometimes it does expect that leap of faith to be a step too far. For instance, it's all well and good having a scientist father as Jor-El was, and then sending off Kal-El from the planet Krypton, the doomed planet Krypton, to Earth. But really, to actually go through a red sun to a different yellow sun giving you superpowers, bit of a leap of faith, that I would have thought.
Absolutely. I mean, we're not saying that the science in superhero fiction is perfect, but what it can be is inspirational. You know, the things that we see Tony Stark doing with regard to the Iron Man suit, we're not just there yet. I've still not got my jetpack as much as I'd like one. But if we don't have that ability to dream and to think about what could be, we'll never get there.
It is very much that notion of becoming an Imagineer, a dreamer, that probably leads up to this fantastic project in which the IET, the Institute of Engineering, of Science and Technology, is connecting with Andy Lanning and Ant Williams to launch the DM Universe, or the Difference Makers Universe. Would you like to share with us what the Difference Makers Universe is all about? Sarita, we'll come to you.
Okay, so the Difference Makers is a fantastic universe where we're showing kids using sort of comic books how our real life superheroes are making a difference. So, for example, we've got Tim Peake in there in cartoon form, telling the kids a little bit about, you know, being an astronaut. And I think it's just that way of connecting with children in a medium that they enjoy that is really important here.
And of course, singing Ground Control for Major Tom as he actually orbits the Earth, a classic Tim Peake moment. Mm-hmm. James, we'll come back to your good self. I mean, technically, I should refer to you as Metal Gear Man or MGM. And clearly, you're actually sort of taking the Tony Stark route here of actually identifying your alter ego to the general public. It's not Metal Gear Man, it's James as well. Extraordinary. Would you like to share with us what you're most excited about in terms of this particular way of ensuring that people can connect with graphic narratives and adventures and so on?
I think what's most exciting is just thinking of, I suppose it sounds a bit strange, but the untapped potential of the imaginations of children that are growing up with this medium of these fantastical films present in their daily lives from the beginning with the visuals that come with that. And that must have an interesting effect on their imagination. I'm sure, I mean, I've myself and probably you growing up have read science fiction, but I think it is different to see it visualize in a way as well. So I think I'm really excited that this initiative provides the opportunity for kids to use their imagination and create designs and contribute to this comic and see those things come to life. I think that would be it's an incredible opportunity for some of these children.
As I mentioned earlier, you're probably far too young to remember Steve Austin or indeed Jamie Summers, but actually modeling a bionic arm on the character of Snake from Metal Gear Solid. Are there moments where you think, actually, this is quite cool, really?
Yes. I mean, the arm that I designed with the team was unlike anything that had ever been made before. It was completely bespoke for myself. And I was fortunate enough that the video game company did fund the arm, but I wasn't limited to creating an arm that looked like an existing character. It was entirely my own science fiction desires and the alternative functions that I wanted that I could bring to life. I know that my friends, because we're kind of become friends in the bionic community, because it's a real thing. There are Metal Gear Solid arms out there with different companies that provide those, so that you can get one. If you're an amputee, you can become a superhero with Open Bionics, for example.
Well, let's move to another little teaser, and let's move to Sarita once again for this as the author of Unmasked, The Science of Superheroes. What is the competition that the IET has actually just launched for children to design their own superhero gadget?
Yes, so one of the co-authors on the report, Matt Dickinson, is supporting the sort of competition elements of this campaign. And we're inviting children aged between 5 and 13 to help design a real world sort of inspirational engineering invention that could perhaps have the opportunity to help save the planet. So there's lots of details on the IET website. So basically just Google engineer a better world and it comes up with all the links and everything you need.
Fantastic. And just share the web address once again with us, Sarita, where people go to.
Yeah, so it's easiest just to head to Google and type in engineer a better world, and it's the first link that's generated.
Excellent. Sarita, you've already admitted being a Doctor Who fan. James, I've got to ask you a question as well. Did you have any particular science fiction superhero or heroine that you particularly were fond of when you were growing up?
I don't know if I'm sure I'm not unique in this, but I feel like I was more interested in the technology and the computers in the scenarios. I think the human characters are great at telling a story, but my imagination was always drawn to how are they doing this? How would they make this work? And I guess I was raised in sort of a Star Trek and indeed Stargate world, where I was just so interested in things like zero point modules that could be an amazing untapped energy source that we've not yet got to. And it's sort of a really interesting example to have unlimited energy.
Absolutely. In fact, I can see you obviously looking to design, as Reed Richards did, the ultimate nullifier to actually deal with the threat of Galactus, devourer of worlds. But that's another time for another event. For the moment, it's been awesome sharing some thoughts with both of you today. Dr. Sarita Robinson, Deputy Head for Psychology and Computer Science at University of Central Lancashire, and James Young, otherwise known, of course, as the one and only Metal Gear Man. Take care and keep saving the world, folks.
Thanks.
Thank you. Have a great day.
1.6 million people financially and digitally underserved in the United Kingdom, with 19 million people also not having the digital or financial skills to improve their lives. This is certainly one of those key elements that's occurring within Britain in the 21st century. And when we're talking about digital engagement, who better to speak to than an awesome individual who's been spending an awful lot of time, in fact, 15 years, working closely with people with complex needs to maximise their income. She's now a support worker with Clean Slate. It's Emma Kernahan. How are you, Emma?
Hi. Hello. Gosh, that does make me feel old.
Well, time is just an illusion, as Einstein once said. All things happen simultaneously. So let's progress from that. But this is a very, very stark figure that we're faced with here in terms of a large number of people, 1.6 million, to be precise, currently being underserved financially and digitally. Were you surprised, or was this something which, in a sense, you kind of said, yeah, actually surprised it wasn't even greater than that?
Yeah, I mean, we weren't that surprised. Obviously, nobody knows what to expect in these, you know, during a global pandemic. We haven't got a lot of experience with those, but we knew that before COVID, people on a low income would stretch their budget, first of all, to cover the priorities, you know, cover their rent, to make sure their housing is sorted out, to make sure that they've got food on the table, that essential transport is covered to work. Those are the priorities for people. And if you've got a very limited budget, what might tend to fall by the wayside is Wi-Fi, having good high-speed Wi-Fi broadband, and having enough devices and devices that work well in order to connect you to the internet. So what we saw during COVID was that there was already a gap there. There was already a gap between those who were able to use the internet and had those skills and devices and those who did not. There was already a gap between rich and poor. And what we've seen since the beginning of the pandemic is the gap widening on both of those fronts.
And that's certainly something which is very critical when it comes to our everyday experience, because so much of our lives does tend to require some kind of online presence. So clearly, if that's not there, or more to the point, people aren't keen to actually use it, or they're unsure as to how to use it, there are obviously going to be challenges built in.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, things have digitized very rapidly since lockdown, necessarily, because everybody was at home. And, you know, even down to universal credit, that's entirely online now. That's accessed online only. And so for those people who were caught during lockdown at home with no access to the internet, it was really difficult for them to access essential information about their finances and to claim the things that they were entitled to, and even to find information about where they might go and get help in order to do that. And it's not just benefits as well. A lot of people have faced a change in circumstances in terms of their employment. And when it comes to working on your CV, in terms of applying for jobs, looking for meaningful work that's well paid or better paid than the job you were doing, all of that happens online. So if you find yourself at home without access to the internet, without the skills to do those things, you really are placing, you know, you're at a disadvantage, and it exacerbates any disadvantage that you might already be experiencing.
Okay, those are the challenges that are faced when you actually go through 5 years of progress in a year in terms of the digital evolution and so on. How can nobody in the dark actually help to begin to address some of these key challenges?
So Nobody in the Dark is a campaign launched by MasterCard, working in partnership with the Good Things Foundation, to make sure that nobody is left behind as we move onwards into the digital world, that nobody is left behind by lack of access to the internet and a lack of access to being able to manage their money really well and maximise their income. And so what they did was they could see the link between a lack of access to the internet and a lack of ability to manage your money really well. And so they worked with Clean Slate, Training and Employment, and a number of other community organisations around the UK to make sure that we linked up those things and we were really explicit about it. And what Clean Slate does is we support people who are on a low income to be better off. And we do that by making sure that everybody is managing their budget as best they possibly can, getting all the help that they can to do that, make sure that people are accessing employment wherever they can. And everything that we do is about using digital tools to do that, to make the most of both of those things.
Education is clearly a very vital aspect of the whole digital world, and change does manifest itself fairly rapidly. You just have to look at how quickly we've had to adopt to using things like Zoom, for instance. Skype is so yesteryear, it's just a different line entirely. So how can people obviously access the education, or indeed actually cross over that potential embarrassment of feeling as though, okay, they might have actually known the kind of basics of how to switch a computer on, but when it comes to some of the other key areas, which we tend to take for granted now, they're a little bit, you know, at sea?
Well, I think the first thing is that sometimes people feel a little bit embarrassed when they don't feel confident in using the internet. But you know what, we know that 8.6% of people in the East Midlands are not using the internet at all. We know that 1 in 7 people can't use the internet without help. So if you feel like you're not confident with the internet, you are most definitely not alone. Everybody has got something that they could improve on their technical skills, and I include myself. And there are loads of places. If you're able to access the internet in the first place, if you're able to Google, there are so many places online that you can access support with learning those beginner skills. And a really good one is the Learn My Way website. If you Google Learn My Way, you'll find a range of videos and bits of information about learning, how to set yourself up with an email address, how to be safe online, and a load of other digital skills that are really designed for people who don't feel confident.
And of course, the key thing there is making sure you hit those first steps online. Just going back a little bit, for people who literally are going into this completely cold and they are, you know, literally entering a whole brave new world, are there any services that actually are offline which can be accessed? Or is it a case of, no, you need to find some place that gives you some online access?
We can. I mean, a lot of what we do is bridging that gap. And it's not always about skills. We know that for a lot of people, actually having the device in the first place and having Wi-Fi and a really decent quality broadband in their home is something that is just not something that they can afford at the moment. And so we work with people over the phone to try and bridge that gap initially. The first thing we do with people is do a money health check. So we have an online tool that we use, and we ask people 25 questions, which are not personal questions. And they are all about general questions about how confident you feel around managing your money. We don't ask anybody, you know, what they've got in their bank account or how much they've got coming in or any of those questions. And out of that, every no answer that you give gives us a heads up that there is work to be done there that we can help you with. We can make an action plan, and we can take a really complex problem that can feel quite overwhelming about not feeling in control of your money, and we can break it down into bite-sized pieces and work out what we're going to do next and help people to take the next step along that journey. So it's all about feeling in control. And then we can help people to use those online tools, even if they don't have access to them. We can work with them on the phone. We're available to support people who have that higher level of need for up to 12 weeks. We speak to people every week. We make sure that they are connected by phone, if needs be, to those specialist services around mental health, around debt, around housing, just to make sure that people are connected, even if they don't have that basic access to the internet. And our goal is always to have a look at a budget and work out where we can make the necessary savings so that we have enough in that budget to connect people to the internet and to access support with getting hold of a device. It's always a priority for us when people are digitally excluded.
And it's worth noting, of course, that the resource hub that is online at nobodyinthedark.co.uk is actually free.
Completely free, absolutely. You know, it's independent and free advice. If anybody feels unsure about their money, and we know that for a lot of people who've been, you know, really hanging on through the last 18 months, it's been difficult for a lot of people in lots of ways. What we've got coming up is maybe a bit of a perfect storm in terms of the end of the universal credit uplift. We've got the end of furlough. We've got a rise in the energy cap that's going up by about £139 a year. We've got winter coming, so those fuel bills are going to go up. And obviously, costs of living are spiralling at the moment in terms of food shortages and just generally. And this is the time of year when people might want to be looking ahead and thinking about saving for Christmas. So that we really want to help people to plan and prepare and feel in control of their money, make sure they're getting all of the help that they can right now, rather than maybe when they've reached a crisis point.
Well, Emma, it's been a delight sharing some of these thoughts with you today. Keep up the excellent work. Emma Kernahan from Clean Slate. keep on keeping on.
Thank you very much.
Shut up.